Nuclear precedent. Always a bad thing to set if it leads to less nuclear safety, more radioactive waste, more danger of future accidents and contamination, but that is what just happened. The Supreme Court has recently made the decision not to hear the petition that challenged the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission's license approval for construction and operation of a consolidated interim storage facility. In other words, a highly radioactive waste dump targeting southeastern New Mexico. By law, that is prohibited. But that doesn't mean it will stay that way. And as a genuine expert on nuclear waste tells us,
a relatively small state, I mean, New Mexico is the fifth largest state in the country in terms of land area, but not in terms of population. The reason that prohibition was put in the Nuclear Waste Policy Act in the first place was at the behest, at the demand of small states like New Mexico, like Nevada, where you can't have a temporary dump storing government-owned spent nuclear fuel in the absence of a repository, because guess what? That surface storage will become de facto permanent. There's nowhere for it to go. And so if the rest of the country can gang up on a small state like New Mexico or Nevada, we're in trouble.
Well, when Kevin Camps, radioactive waste specialist at Beyond Nuclear and a veteran warrior in this battle, warns us about what can go wrong that's just on the legislative horizon, you understand once again how we are all stuck in that awful, dangerous, deadly seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. We're a show for people who know nothing about nuclear who want to know something, and people who know something about nuclear who would like to know just a little bit more. My name is Libby Halevy. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, the latest update on the long-running ongoing battle to prevent a nuclear waste dump from being sited in New Mexico. We talk with Kevin Camps, radioactive waste watchdog with Beyond Nuclear, on what it means that the Supreme Court has recently refused to hear a petition to void the license to build a consolidated waste storage facility in New Mexico, and where that might lead. It's a step in a direction that could prove dangerous not only to New Mexico, but to any state that has a nuclear reactor that would be in line to ship highly radioactive spent nuclear fuel over our roads and rails. We will also learn about Greenland and a 2016 award-winning film on that country's long-standing fight against uranium mining. It's an on-the-ground look at the country, its people, and the battle that was eventually won, but now is in danger of being voided by Donald Trump's threat to take over the country for its uranium and rare earth minerals. We will also have nuclear news from around the world. Numbnuts of the Week for Outstanding Nuclear Boneheadedness, Linda Pence Gunter with the Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story, and a whole lot of honest nuclear information. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, January 20th, 2016, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Starting out with an international perspective, January can always be a bit of a bleak month. And with the way things are looking in some of the mainstream media conversations about nuclear weapons, it's time to remind people that the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons has reached a global majority, that countries are pushing back against nuclear weapons, and that this is a problem that dedicated campaigners believe can absolutely be solved. To give you a little bit of background, the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, or TPNW, the Nuclear Weapons Ban Treaty, is the first legally binding international agreement to comprehensively prohibit nuclear weapons, with the ultimate goal being their total elimination. It was adopted on the 7th of July, 2017, opened for signatures 2 months later, and entered into force on the 22nd of January, 2021. To date, more than half the countries of the world have signed on. For those states that are party to it, the treaty prohibits the development, testing, production, stockpiling, stationing, transfer, use, and threat of use of nuclear weapons, as well as prohibiting assistance and encouragement to the prohibited activities. For nuclear-armed states joining the treaty, it provides a time-bound framework for negotiations leading to the verified and irreversible elimination of its nuclear weapons program. 'Tis a consummation devoutly to be wished. We'll have a link to some of the resources put together by the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, or ICAN, up on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 760. As for the nuclear weapons state, the New START Nuclear Arms Control Treaty is about to expire, and Russia has said that it has had no specific contact with the U.S. regarding this imminent expiration. This according to Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. To fill in your understanding, New START is a nuclear arms reduction treaty between the United States and the Russian Federation with the formal name of Measures for the Further Reduction and Limitation of Strategic Offensive Arms. It was signed on April 8, 2010, and after ratification, it entered into force on February 5, 2011. Now, this treaty, the last of its kind between Moscow and Washington, and the one that sets limits on the number of deployed nuclear warheads the world's two biggest nuclear powers can have, is due to expire on February 5th, just over 2 weeks from now. Russian President Vladimir Putin has offered to voluntarily uphold the treaty's terms for a year after it expires if the United States does the same. But Moscow says it has not yet received a formal response to the Putin offer. U.S. President Donald Trump has said he would like China to be part of any replacement agreement, something Beijing has always rejected. Lavrov said Russia understood China's position since the size of Beijing's nuclear arsenal was far smaller than Russia's or the United States. And so the clock is ticking and we wait. Here in the U.S., there's even worse news at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, as environmental oversight is set to be weakened. Here's Linda Pence Gunter with this week's Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story.
Last week, we talked about all the president's yes men and the alarming developments at the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, where there is now a 3-2 majority who could well rubber stamp any and every reactor for which the Trump administration and its industry cronies want a rushed approval. But the plot thickens. We've had a chance now to look into Trump's latest appointment of newly confirmed NRC Commissioner Ho Ni as chair. Ni's past seems likely to come back to haunt not him, but us. We are in trouble. New reactor promoters are lining up for approval, and they expect to get it. Chairman Ni, perhaps still a touch dizzy from all the revolving doors he's been spinning through, had a stint at the Institute of Nuclear Power Operations, or IMPO. He was placed there while serving as Vice President of Regulatory Affairs at Southern Nuclear Company, which owns and operates 8 nuclear reactors in Alabama and Georgia. IMPO is composed of the nation's senior nuclear utility executives. It was created in 1979 by the U.S. nuclear power industry in direct response to the March 28 Three Mile Island nuclear accident in Pennsylvania. INPO operates as an industry-funded private entity and serves as the shadow regulator to the NRC. It remains entirely off the public radar, and its so-called safety reports are guarded secrets and withheld from NRC public records as proprietary. INPO reports are kept secret to encourage the nuclear industry to self-regulate. That means that when an honest behind-closed-doors assessment is made there regarding safety concerns, they don't want the public knowing about it. They would rather self-police it and remedy the situation from the inside. But why on earth would we trust them to do it, especially when we know safety fixes cost money? Those costly safety fixes are about to hit head-on with the slew of unsafe, untested new reactors queuing up to get their construction licenses, with Bill Gates's TerraPower Natrium reactor first in line, as we reported last week. And that's where the news gets even worse. In the interest of accelerating reactor licensing, the NRC is apparently looking to dispense with the cumbersome process of requiring nuclear companies seeking new or extended licenses for their reactors to produce an environmental impact statement required under the now jeopardized National Environmental Policy Act, known as NEPA. Instead, the NRC would ask for significantly less detailed environmental assessments. There is only one reason for doing this, and it's not to be more scrutinous of safety issues. Rather, it's because historically, the NRC and the nuclear industry have claimed and complained that environmental reviews just take too long and are overly burdensome, which of course slows down the hands poised to slam down those rubber stamps and meet the insane 12 to 18 month timetable set by the White House to approve new reactor projects. I'm Linda Pence-Gunter with Beyond Nuclear, reporting for Nuclear Hot Seat. And that's this week's hot story.
Keeping in mind that weakening of radiation protection standards, our good friend, award-winning veteran environmental journalist Carl Grossman, has published an important article in counterpunch.org entitled A Nuclear-Free New York. In it, he cites the first of a series of forums for a nuclear-free New York that was held last week, following New York Governor Kathy Hochul's proposition for an expansion of nuclear power in New York State. She has called for an increase in energy generation, the equivalent of four large nuclear power plants, and continued her drive, started in 2025, to push the state to become the center of a nuclear power revival in the United States. In rebuttal, the first forum, a webinar on January 15, entitled Symposium for Safe and Affordable Energy in New York, was organized by a coalition of safe energy and environmental organizations and moderated by actor Alec Baldwin, a longstanding nuclear power opponent. It featured Mark Z. Jacobson, professor of civil and environmental engineering at Stanford University, and Joseph Mangano, executive director of the Radiation and Public Health Project. Among the criticisms of Hochul, Baldwin said, Governor Hochul arranged a $33 billion ratepayer subsidy to keep four aging reactors in upstate New York operating for another 20 years, including the oldest and the second oldest reactors in the U.S. Baldwin continued, Hochul's nuclear push is taking place amid unprecedented dismantling of federal nuclear regulation, rubber stamping, and fast-tracking new nuclear projects and dumbing down federal radiation exposure standards. Those concerns need more attention, and so do clean, renewable sources of energy that can meet New York power needs and climate goals without the health and safety risks of nuclear. Professor Jacobson, who is an expert on alternative energy, said, "Nuclear is not helpful or useful. It will not help New York State at all, regardless of how much money is poured down to it. It will also increase risk and increase air pollution compared with alternatives. Also, it is obsolete already and is not needed because there are alternatives." We'll link to this article because it is extensive and important and should serve as a warning to any state that is thinking of pursuing nuclear power but has not considered its downfalls or the possible and positive alternatives. And this story, sourced from Newsweek, that Trump is building a secret White House bunker to withstand nuclear attack. And you thought it was all about a ballroom. A ballroom estimated to cost $400 million. The decades-old underground complex beneath the White House East Wing, which included the Presidential Emergency Operations Center, or PEOC, that sounds appropriate, was dismantled during the controversial demolition tied to Trump's new ballroom project, with plans for a classified replacement using modern technology already underway. And for this, Newsweek cites CNN. During a National Capital Planning Commission meeting, a senior White House official referenced top secret work as the reason demolition proceeded before typical approvals, while a recent court filing argued that halting underground construction would endanger national security. The planned underground space will include the Presidential Emergency Operations Center, beds, supplies, and secure communications, and was described by sources as a self-contained unit with separate backups for power, water, and air filtration. Jonathan Wackrow, a former U.S. Secret Service agent, told CNN that any successor to the current underground facility would need to anticipate and withstand emerging threats, from nuclear blasts and airplane impacts to chemical, biological, and electromagnetic dangers, while keeping its capabilities hidden from adversaries. He said, "You're talking about a highly classified site, built in total secrecy, designed to endure both today's threat landscape and whatever comes next. In other words, Mr. President, we must not allow a mineshaft gap." And now,
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Numbnuts of the Week.
An Army base in Alaska responsible for protecting the U.S. homeland from nuclear missile attack has struggled to feed its soldiers in recent months because of the Trump administration's effort to shrink the federal workforce. This according to a military document. Fort Greely is tucked in the rugged interior of the 49th state. The base has experienced a, quote, critical disruption in food service operations after the remote Army base lost essential federal civilian cooks in the wake of efforts to shrink the workforce, according to an Army official whose name was redacted in an official contract document published on January 7th. The document, a legal justification for an emergency no-bid contract awarded to staff from the fort's dining facility, blamed the issue on staff retirements combined with a federal hiring freeze and a buyout program launched by Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE. The food service disruption could have resulted in mission failure if the deal hadn't gone through to hire additional staff via Alaska's State Department of Labor and Workforce Development. The post in this bitterly cold corner of Alaska is home to approximately 350 soldiers who operate 40 of the military's 44 specialized missiles designed to shoot down nuclear or other ballistic missiles targeting the United States. Well, this is a plot point that Catherine Bigelow didn't take into account in her film A House of Dynamite. Since October of 2025, Fort Greely has faced a reduction in dining facility operating hours, forcing impacted soldiers to purchase food from the tiny town adjoining the base, Delta Junction, with a 2020 population of only 918, and has only a handful of food stores and restaurants. The command had to secure dinners, weekend meals, from a local vendor. Robert Evans, a veteran and quality of life advocate for soldiers who created the HOTS and COTS app for troops to review their living conditions, told USA Today that the Fort Greely food service disruption represents, quote, a quality of life failure, comparable to early warning signs from the Deferred Resignation Program at Fort Hood in Texas, where leadership acknowledged impacts to barracks quality and work order response times. Oh, that's great. I'm sorry. My blood sugar is low. My stomach is rumbling. Whoops, is that a Russian missile overhead? Shucky darns. Guess I was too faint to spot it in time. So here is, yet again, another example of nuclear as the land of unintended consequences and collateral damage, which makes this story of underfed U.S. soldiers this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Numbnuts of the Week.
We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment. But first, as we kick off 2026, Nuclear Hot Seat is in the process of upgrading itself. And we are going through a lot of changes behind the scenes that you will see in the coming weeks. Right now, we are working with the intent of including transcripts on each week's episode. YouTube postings will be created to provide another platform for people to find us. There's expansion into additional social media platforms. And who knows? There might be a Nuclear 101 series of short videos to explain the kinds of intro talking points that we old-timers take for granted, but that confuse the heck out of the newer generations of climate activists. All of these are in the works, as well as a way to speed up the editing process for each week's show, which currently takes more hours than you could possibly imagine. It's exciting that I have finally found someone to coach me who is both skilled in social media, backed by a team, and staunchly anti-nuclear. I could use another half dozen of her. Growth. It's a good thing, but it's also not an inexpensive thing. New software with annual fees, monthly fees, and a lot of incidental charges around the edges on top of what it already costs to run this show. And for that, I need you. Yes, you. Nuclear Hot Seat runs on donations, and without them, the show cannot continue. So in as nice a way as possible, I'm asking for your assistance and support as we continue moving through 2026. That's why the time would be right now to support us with a donation of any size. Go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the red donate button, then follow the prompts. We make it easy. If you have Zelle, you can send money directly to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And with Zelle, no fees are taken out. Nuclear Hot Seat is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that anything you donate is tax deductible. Any amount helps, so don't wait. Go now to nuclearhotseat.com to donate. And know that whatever you can do to help, I am deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now, here's this week's featured interview. Last week, we learned that the U.S. Supreme Court has refused to hear a petition by Beyond Nuclear to block the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission's license approval for construction and operation of Holtec International's highly radioactive waste consolidated interim storage facility targeting southeastern New Mexico. Fortunately, hard-won state laws in both New Mexico and Texas, because one of these consolidated interim storage facilities is under consideration there, these state laws block the opening of these environmentally unjust CSIFs, as they're called, by prohibiting the issuance of state permits needed to break ground unless the state consents. Still, the way to maintain this block to creating these nuclear waste dumps has been made more difficult, and an outcome that supports and maintains the current situation is not guaranteed. To learn more, we spoke with Kevin Camps, radioactive waste watchdog, some of us like to think of him more like a bulldog, with Beyond Nuclear. He's a veteran of this battle, knows where all the nuclear bodies are buried, and keeps trying to bury more of them. Metaphorically speaking, of course. We spoke with Kevin Camps on January 16, 2026. Kevin Camps, always great to have you here with us on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thanks for having me.
Set us up to understand the situation we find ourselves in now. What was Beyond Nuclear addressing most recently regarding the Holtec International highly radioactive waste consolidated interim storage facility targeting southeastern New Mexico?
Well, Beyond Nuclear is a decade into this legal fight, and it takes a lot of hard work and 10 years of our lives to get this far. We've never gotten our day in court on Holtec's dump in New Mexico, not in the NRC licensing proceedings that went on for years, not in the federal courts of appeals processes that have gone on for years. So we decided to give it one last chance, and we appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, asking for our day in court on various issues that have not been resolved, that have not been addressed. And unfortunately, the Supreme Court denied our petition for a writ of certiorari just a few days ago. So it's over. And we can get into more detail, but the unfortunate part of all this, the tragic part, is that the illegalities that are baked into the Holtec license that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission approved in 2023 are still in there. And there is the silver lining that Holtec has admitted defeat in New Mexico and says it's leaving the state, will look to other states for what they call collaborative siting. But they can take that license with them, and they can take the illegalities baked into that license with them, and through an NRC license amendment request, which NRC will probably rubber stamp relatively quickly, they could try to apply that license in another state, such as Arkansas. Or Holtec could make up with its New Mexico business partner, Eddie Lee Energy Alliance, and carry forward on the very site that's been targeted all along with this license that the Supreme Court has essentially blessed. So there's all kinds of versions as to how this is not good going forward legally. And we tried to stop it in the Supreme Court, but were denied our day in court.
Is there any overall reason given why you have been denied court access so many times?
The NRC, Holtec, the DC Circuit Court of Appeals have all agreed with Beyond Nuclear on a certain point that it is illegal for a private storage site like Holtec's in New Mexico to store federal government-owned spent nuclear fuel. It's clear as day in the Nuclear Waste Policy Act that that is prohibited, and that is the law of the land. And that's what we've been hooting and hollering about all these years. What we do not agree with the other side on, including the courts, is that having an illegal provision in a license, in contract language, is okay, is legal. It's not. It's unlawful. And yet that's exactly the case with Holtec in New Mexico. It's also the case with Interim Storage Partners in Texas, another consolidated interim storage facility that the NRC has licensed and the Supreme Court has blessed, unfortunately. It says right in the license and right in the contract language that Department of Energy spent nuclear fuel can be stored at these facilities. That's a direct violation of the Nuclear Waste Policy Act. And when an agency like the NRC disregards a law like the Nuclear Waste Policy Act by the NRC, that's another violation. That's called violating the Administrative Procedure Act. So we've made these arguments. We made other arguments about the separation of powers because the other side said, no, this illegal provision in the license and the contract language is okay because Congress might change the law someday. So we'll just let it be in there until Congress gets around to changing the law. And that's a very telling argument because now that we've ended our judicial process, guess where this fight moves? It moves into Congress because Holtec's lobbyists, Interim Storage Partners lobbyists, the nuclear industry's lobbyists, which are a powerful political force on Capitol Hill, one of the most powerful, they're up there as we speak, waving around the Supreme Court decision from a few days ago, asking Congress to please now change the law. And the significance of this change of the law is that a relatively small state, I mean, New Mexico is the fifth largest state in the country in terms of land area, but not in terms of population. The reason that prohibition was put in the Nuclear Waste Policy Act in the first place was at the behest, at the demand of small states like New Mexico, like Nevada, where you can't have a temporary dump storing government-owned spent nuclear fuel in the absence of a repository, because guess what? That surface storage will become de facto permanent. There's nowhere for it to go. And so if the rest of the country can gang up on a small state like New Mexico or Nevada, we're in trouble. I mean, you know, one nation under God, indivisible, unless we're talking about high-level radioactive waste, and then it's every state for themselves and majority rules. So that provision was very wisely put into the law in 1982 by small states to defend themselves. And unfortunately, because of this illegality at the heart of these licenses, all bets are off. The only thing we got going for us is very hard-won state laws in New Mexico and Texas that took years to accomplish, tremendous efforts by the grassroots movements in those states to get their governors and their state legislatures in a good position on these questions, and finally did. Those state laws are still in place, but just recently, the Eddie Lee Energy Alliance, which is still blinded by radioactive dollar signs in southeastern New Mexico, announced that they will challenge the New Mexico state law. Holtec actually had said they would challenge the New Mexico state law on the very day it was enacted back in 2023. They've not done that. But because we don't trust these folks, we have to worry about every possibility. And I mentioned some of them about Holtec and Aaliyah or another company that the license is sold to carrying forward in New Mexico. And we've got similar problems in Texas, but we do have those state laws. The fight moves to Congress. We need to educate Congress about its own history, the legislative history of the Nuclear Waste Policy Act, so that they don't do something really stupid like legalize these bad ideas.
So the focus of this appeal to the Supreme Court was southeastern New Mexico, correct?
Yeah, this was the case of Holtec's Consolidated Interim Storage Facility in New Mexico, but the two cases overlap so much. They're really identical proposals, except for the most devilish of details, like which containers would be used. And then if you question the proponents, the dump developers, they admit that actually, no, we really could accommodate any container. Texas has especially said this. The Texas dump has said we could accommodate Holtec's containers at our site. And Holtec has said we could send our containers to Texas. The New Mexico site's a bit different because supposedly the storage pits are designed for Holtec containers, but push comes to shove, they could try to put other containers in there in these pits with a simple license amendment request to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which at this point is a high-speed rubber stamp machine. We're seeing that at Palisades, you name the proceeding, new reactor proceedings. The NRC is just in regulatory free fall without a parachute, under direct orders from President Trump, the Department of Government Efficiency, et cetera.
What is being done or what needs to be done to bolster or support the protective laws that are already in place in New Mexico and Texas?
Well, ultimately, that's going to unfortunately be the burden of our colleagues on the ground in those states who've already worked so hard for so long and suffered so much. I mean, the environmental injustice of these schemes is hard to overstate. And so people have dedicated their lives willingly, but it takes a toll. I'll tell you, I'm talking about the grassroots in New Mexico and Texas. So, you know, we'll support them in any way we can, as we have this whole time. But really, for the rest of us, outside of those states, what we need to do is be talking to our U.S. representative and both of our U.S. senators, because the next big fight is to try to prevent the nuclear lobbyists from doing what's been baked into this scheme all along, which is as soon as it's legal, these private storage sites will start taking Department of Energy-owned spent nuclear fuel. And it's really blurring the lines on who holds the title to the waste in general. So these companies have made filthy profits on generating highly radioactive waste, but it's still on their ledgers, as it should be. They made it. Unfortunately, there was a promise made by the federal government that they would deal with this stuff someday by opening a repository. And when that happened, then the title would transfer from the private companies to the U.S. Department of Energy, which is the taxpayer. But we're not there yet. We don't have a repository. The Nuclear Waste Policy Act is a carefully crafted compromise where the U.S. federal government said, we will take this waste off your hands, private nuclear industry, but only once we have a repository, a permanent geologic repository. That's what the law says. So now the nuclear industry is trying to loosen that language. Essentially, is what they're after is a title transfer at these temporary storage sites. And when that happens, it makes it all the more likely that they will become de facto permanent surface storage. I call them parking lot dumps. And these containers someday are going to breach if they're not maintained, if they're not replaced. And once they breach because of corrosion or natural disasters or extreme weather or intentional attack or whatever happens, just plain rust over time, they will release their contents. And their contents are forever deadly, highly radioactive waste that will then begin to blow with the wind, flow with the water, contaminate the food supply, contaminate the drinking water supply. That's what happens when you abandon high-level radioactive wastes on the surface of planet Earth. So that's what they're trying to do, and that's our challenge to prevent.
It would be easier, perhaps common, for people to go, well, this is a problem in New Mexico, or this is a problem in Texas, and I live in Maine or Oregon or someplace else. Explain why, with transport, there would be many more states, many more people, many more areas put in jeopardy by a scheme like this.
Well, if you draw a line down the middle of the United States, 90% of the reactors and the waste are to the east of that center line. And actually, 75% of the reactors and the waste in this country are east of the Mississippi River. So yet again, as with Yucca Mountain, Nevada, on Western Shoshone land, this is very much east dumping on west in a very real sense. Yes, there are reactors on the West Coast, but most of the reactors are in the eastern part of this country. So when you choose dump sites in the west, like Holtex in New Mexico, that exacerbates the transportation risks because the shipment miles add up and you can have severe accidents, crashes, fires, underwater submersions. You can have terrorist attacks. You can have contaminated shipments emitting gamma radiation as they roll through town. But even without contamination, the shielding is thin enough that there is gamma and neutron coming off of these shipments. So you're exacerbating all those risks and impacts with these long distance transports by the thousands. And then just to make matters worse, you're actually automatically doubling the transportation risks because these are supposedly temporary sites and the waste will have to go to a permanent repository some decade or some century in the future. Then you got transported again. So they're exacerbating the transportation risks, which again is a violation of the Nuclear Waste Policy Act, where that was supposed to be mitigated. The original plan under the Nuclear Waste Policy Act that was abandoned over just a few years was a dump in the east and a dump in the west. If a dump in the west opened first, as at Yucca Mountain, Nevada, then there had to be a limit to how much waste could go there because we can't have one state bearing the burden for the entire country. This law was carefully crafted back in 1982 with a lot of compromise. Small states with small populations standing up because they didn't want to get screwed by the rest of the country. Unfortunately, those compromises were thrown out the window with the Screw Nevada Bill of 1987. That's what most people call it. The rest of the country ganged up on Nevada. Nevada fought it off. It took decades. But here we go again. In a sense, these court rulings, these NRC shenanigans amount to screw New Mexico, screw West Texas. We're going to do this, whether it's legal or not. And incredibly, that's what's so astounding is the courts have blessed these licenses by taking no action on the illegalities within them. So we're going to have to get very creative in our resistance to these dumps now. A silver lining is that Holtec has admitted defeat, supposedly, in New Mexico. We don't believe them. We don't believe a word they say ever because they lie constantly. So we'll keep an eye on what they're doing in New Mexico or not. But they're certainly a part of the Department of Energy's now collaborative siting initiative, used to be called consent-based siting, which is a concern that they felt the need to change the name away from consent. They're looking at states like Arkansas, Holtec is. They're being paid U.S. taxpayer money to go into a town in Arkansas and bamboozle the local leadership to try to convince them that this is a great idea. there was just one of these meetings held. I don't know that Holtec was a part of it because there's various partners working with the Department of Energy. They went up to Vernon, Vermont, and tried to convince the former host town of the Vermont Yankee Atomic Reactor, which still has the high-level waste there, by the way, to take high-level waste from a bunch of other Northeastern nuclear power plants to the tune of 15,000 metric tons, about 15% of what exists in the country right now, and store it there on the former nuclear power plant site or nearby, right on the Connecticut River, in exchange for money. You know, when it's a low-income and or Black, Indigenous, people of color community being targeted with these schemes and money being dangled before them, that's legalized bribery. That's environmental injustice. There's a quote from an Ojibwe environmental leader in the Great Lakes, Keith Lewis at Serpent River First Nation. He said, "There's nothing moral about bribing a starving man with money." And he was talking about the uranium mining in their community. But wouldn't you know, their community, devastated by decades of uranium mining, is also has been targeted by the Canadian government for the high-level radioactive waste dump for that country. It's been fought off. So most times in the U.S., it's indigenous lands that are targeted. Yucca Mountain, Nevada is Western Shoshone. Holtec site in New Mexico, there are two dozen or more indigenous nations that have ties to that land. Yes, they've been driven away from that land, but there are sacred sites there. It's considered the most archaeological rich site in New Mexico, which is really saying something. And the same is true of the Texas site. Of course, there are Latinx communities there now. New Mexico is majority minority. The Latinx and indigenous population is the majority of the population in New Mexico. And it's even more so down in the Southeast. So yet again, low income BIPOC communities are being targeted. The courts have nothing to say about the illegalities of the matter. And I think it just really shows the political and economic power of the nuclear industry, which of course is closely connected to the weapons industry and the power industry. They're flip sides of the same coin. So again, it's a battle for the soul of America, as Joe Biden put it. And in this context, it's a battle against this industry that is just way too powerful and tramples people if they get in the way.
Where does that leave Beyond Nuclear, you, us, all of us who oppose nuclear and see the insanity of this going forward? What do we do?
Well, on stopping these consolidated interim storage facilities, whether in New Mexico, Texas, or elsewhere in the country, because they're looking all over the country right now in this collaborative siting process, the action is in Capitol Hill. Congress is funding these initiatives, giving the Department of Energy the money to pay the whole tax of this world. We need to put a stop to that. We need to get Congress to remember the reasons why these precautions were put in the Nuclear Waste Policy Act to begin with, and that they should not be changed, they should not be weakened, they should not be done away with in the year 2026 just because the industry lobbyists want them to. You know, the industry's had this waste problem from the start. In 1942, we don't know what to do with the first cupful of highly radioactive waste that Enrico Fermi generated in the Chicago pile number one during the Manhattan Project. So we're a ways into this hole now, and we need to be careful and not make fatal mistakes. And so that needs to happen with Congress. Every single American citizen has a U.S. representative and two U.S. senators. You need to be in touch with them, and not just once. You need to educate them to do the right thing here and not go along with the industry on this. So that'll be what's ahead. We've been fighting that battle since I've been in Washington, which I moved there in 1999, and we've been largely successful. They have not changed the Nuclear Waste Policy Act. They didn't get away with Yucca Mountain. But as folks are probably aware, Congress is misbehaving pretty badly these days. So we've got a real challenge, and we'll do our best to prevail.
Is there anything that we haven't covered that you would like to as we move forward on this?
Well, I'll just emphasize that the transportation issue, mobile Chernobyl, floating Fukushimas, dirty bombs on wheels, 3 Mile Islands in transit, mobile X-ray machines that can't be turned off. That issue woke up the country on Yucca Mountain, and we won that fight. We need to wake the country up again, because the very same risks apply to these consolidated interim storage facilities for most states in the lower 48, whether it's by the trains, whether it's by roads, or whether it's surface water barging or boating. You name the coastline, you name the river, you name the lake, the Great Lakes, they want to barge this stuff. So it's everybody's problem. When it comes to nuclear waste transportation, we all live in New Mexico. We all live in Texas. We all live in Nevada. So people need to get active to protect their own neck of the woods on this stuff.
Kevin, you've been doing yeoman's duty on this for decades now. And I would like to thank you for once again coming on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thanks for your kind words.
Kevin Camps, Radioactive Waste Watchdog with Beyond Nuclear. And now here's a second feature. With U.S. President Donald Trump taking aim on Greenland and his stated intent of taking over control of the country, with his unstated but well-known desire to claim and mine its uranium and rare earth minerals, we decided to revisit and bring to your attention a 2016 film on Greenland, proposed uranium mining, and the fight by locals to block it from this mostly pristine country. Professor Lisa Autogina and Joshua Portway made the film Kanersut Kvanfjeld, which I was privileged to view at the 2018 International Uranium Film Festival. The film portrays the conflict facing the small community of Narsaq in southern Greenland. Narsaq is located next to the pristine Kvanefjeld Mountain, site of one of the richest rare earth mineral resources deposits in the world and one of the largest sources of uranium. For generations, the farming near Kvanefjeld has been Greenland's only agricultural industry. At the time the film was made, this way of life was in danger of being threatened, as Greenland considered foreign investments in an open pit mine that could become the fifth largest uranium mine and second biggest rare earth extraction operation in the world. Autogina and Portway's film portrays a community divided on the issue of uranium mining. It explores the difficult decisions and trade-offs faced by a culture seeking to escape a colonial past and define its own identity in a globalized world. While this film was released 10 years ago, it is one of the few resources we have for actually hearing from the residents of that country, what they value, and the threats their mineral resources have already put them through. While the dangers expressed specifically in this film have passed, current events are bringing them, and worse, back into play again. Kanersut Kvanefjeld was a winner at the International Uranium Film Festival and remains one of the only resources we have for understanding the issues faced by the people of Greenland. Here we have a brief clip of filmmaker Lisa Autogina speaking at the 2018 International Uranium Film Festival held in Window Rock, Navajo Nation, Arizona. She's reading a letter from one Greenlander. It's from Nuclear Hot Seat number 390, December 12, 2018. I apologize because the sound is not great, but it's worth listening to, and it's only 3 minutes long. We'll give you a link to the film after this clip. With global warming revealing deposits of uranium and rare earth in Greenland, the global rush of extractive industries to stake a claim and dig in one of the most pristine tracts of land left on Earth is being held in check only by the need of this former Danish colony to hold a referendum with the people in 2019. Producer and co-director Lisa Autogina attended the festival and spoke with the audience after the screening. She started by reading a letter from a Greenland anti-nuclear activist.
Here, we are fighting so that uranium will not be extracted in this country. But it's difficult because many of our politicians think that we're going to make money from it because they're not properly informed about the consequences. I'm afraid we will lose our culture, our clean air and water, as we only live 6 to 7 kilometers from the planned mine. So we need all the help we can get in terms of information about the consequences of mining uranium at the Kvanefjeld Mountain. so that our politicians can become more informed and able to make the right decisions. The film that you are going to see is a film that has been shown in an exhibition that has been traveling around Europe for the last 2 years. It's good to know that Greenland is a place where only 56,000 people live, in a country that is so big that it goes all the way from Scandinavia down to Africa. There's hardly any roads. The town's very, very small, and there's like very few roads in the town, so you can't really drive very far at all. So you basically can only get around this country with helicopters and ships. And that makes it a very difficult country to run when you're so few people. At the moment, because of climate change happening, there's a lot of focus on the Arctic and on Greenland because of the melting ice sheet is opening up all sorts of new opportunities in the future for mining. So a lot of organizations from around the world are looking at Greenland and trying to find ways to get involved in the Arctic. And so there is a lot of kind of geopolitical stuff surrounding this mine, and this mine in a way has become a symbol of the kind of choices that Greenland has to make for the future, which is, on one hand, a population that's desperate to become independent, create a new nation. But to do that, they will need very fast and big income. And the only way to get this income is through mining. So the big, huge decisions that Greenland has to make about its future is very much this kind of choice between either thinking of very slow development, finding a very slow way of developing a new country, which is not based on this big money, or get rid of Denmark and get big organizations to invest in mining in Greenland. But the big question is, how is it possible for Greenland to control the situation and deal with companies that have much bigger money just in one company than the whole country of Greenland has? It's a very vulnerable situation right now.
Co-director Liza Ottojina. The referendum referenced in this letter did succeed in blocking foreign investment in mining operations in Greenland at that time. All, however, is up for grabs now with Donald Trump's threatened recolonization and takeover of the country of Greenland. But this is what underlies the current drive by our current administration to unilaterally claim and take over an entire nation. We'll have a link up to where you can view Kwanisut Gvanfjeld, a 30-minute film, on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 760.
Activists, shout out.
Kimberly Roberson, who is our food and health watchdog, she's founder of the Fukushima Fallout Awareness Network, or FAN, and also a certified nutrition educator, has published an excellent piece in thehill.com. It's entitled, Shrimp with a Side of Cancer? Radioactive Contamination is Real. In it, she goes over the recent findings of seafood contaminated with radioactive cesium-134 that was coming through Indonesia, as reported on Nuclear Hot Seat number 740 on September 3rd, 2025, where we interviewed Kimberly on this exact subject. In this article, she reiterates her points and builds upon them. We'll have that link up on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 760. The White House has told the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to allow more radiation exposure to our communities, workers, and the whole of our living planet Earth. So Nuclear Information Resource Center, or NIRS, Beyond Nuclear, and Generational Radiation Impact Project, or GRIP, are responding with 4 information organizing sessions. They will be online and hosted by Cindy Folkers of Beyond Nuclear, Diane DiRico of NIRS, and Mary Olson of Generation Radiation Impact Project. Each session will also feature a guest expert. Their goal is to get us to work together to mobilize public comments on the NRC's plan to reduce radiation protection for the public and workers. Come online and learn more and share ideas for how to turn out comments from everyone in a 30-day period when the NRC publishes its draft rule in February, exact date unknown. These knowledgeable veterans will provide key information and then ask you to put on your organizer hats to think together about how to turn out large numbers of comments to the NRC. There is a resource page with links to primary documents, commentaries, and videos, and we will, of course, link to it on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 760. The sessions begin on Friday, January 23rd, 2026, from 1 to 2 Eastern Time, followed by Tuesday, January 27, 7 to 8 Eastern Time, Friday, January 30th, from noon to 1 p.m. Eastern, and Thursday, February 5th, 2 to 3 Eastern. Of course, on our link, you'll be able to see those dates for yourself and mark them down in your calendars, so please join us and help put your brain power to work figuring out how in the world we can not only respond to ourselves, but motivate others to do so as well. And a reminder again this week that next Tuesday, January 27, 2026, the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists will announce the new setting for the Doomsday Clock. This during a live news conference at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, which is also 1500 Greenwich Mean Time. In 2025, the Doomsday Clock was set at 89 seconds to midnight. The closest to midnight, representing nuclear annihilation on the planet Earth, that it has ever been set in the clock's 78-year history. The decision is made every year in consultation with the Bulletin's Board of Sponsors, which includes 8 Nobel laureates. Here at Nuclear Hot Seat, I hope for a frightening drop in this symbolic time between where we are and a total nuclear wipeout. Find out for sure with the rest of us on January 27, when the ceremony will be streamed live via the Bulletin's YouTube channel. And of course, we will have a link up on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 760. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, January 20th, 2026. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, it's a snap. You can sign up for it on your favorite podcast channel or cut to the chase and just go to nuclearhotseat.com. There's a big yellow opt-in box that will pop up asking you to put in your first name, an email address, and send it to us. Then every week you will get one email with the link to the show as soon as it posts, along with a short description of the show's content. That way, you never have to risk losing out on a single episode because who knows where it will be focused. It might be the nuclear reactor and nuclear potential disaster right next door. Now, if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we will really appreciate it, especially with our new expansion on the table right now. So thank you for any amount, because anything will help us, and we always appreciate you and your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2026, Libby Halevi and Hartestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, names of any guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you that in honor of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day, which was just yesterday, a reminder that he said, "It is very nice to drink milk at an unsegregated lunch counter, but not when there's strontium-90 in it." There you have it, your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So, whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.